It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we trace American history through Christmas cards through the years.
But first, a new bill is circulating at the state capitol. Republican Representative Samantha Kirkman's bill would make it a felony to defraud the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Representative Kirkman joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Great to be here.
So why does the state need an anti-fraud law that's directed specifically at WEDIC?
Well, we have other statutes on the books with regards to fraud, but in my previous working on other fraud bills, noticed that it's challenging for our district attorneys if they're not specific to a specific type of fraud of state government. So when I was working on the unemployment bill, we had a hearing on that bill, and it came up, and shortly thereafter I put a bill, this bill, into drafting, and I guess Senator Hansen at the same time had his bill put into drafting. He got his out about 3 weeks before I did. He's a different drafter. And, you know, when I saw his bill come out, I decided to reach out to him because our bills aren't that different. And so we sat down and we reached the compromise with the bill that we've put forth today.
And what kinds of penalties does this bill call for?
It calls for, it's a Class E felony, so punishable by up to 15 years in prison and a fine of $50,000. The previous bills that I'd been working on with were a Class G felony, so a lesser fine and penalty. Senator Hansen was a little bit higher, so again, we reached a compromise at a Class E felony.
Now, there have been several high-profile cases of fraud against WEDIC, and this included companies or individuals that included false statements on their applications. Now, is this bill, would you say that's a direct response to that?
Well, anytime somebody frauds state government, be it in the food share program or be it in the unemployment program or be it in WEDC, there should be penalties associated with it. And I just felt very important to actually put something on the books to give a tool to our district attorneys that if somebody does fraud out a program, that there is, you know, there is a crime or there is a deterrent and a penalty involved with that.
Now, WEDIC is trying to recover some of this lost money in the courts,
correct.
So would this law be retroactively applied to those cases?
It is not retroactive to those cases. It's just going forward. So, again, it's putting that deterrent on the books. Like I said, there are other fraud statutes on the books, but it's hard to prosecute. And then each agency does have the ability to go back internally through their administrative rules process. They can in unemployment. They can in health services. But then there isn't the criminal penalty aspect of it. So when you actually put something on the books, it gives that tool to that district attorney in that local county to charge if they so feel.
Well, specifically, what types of things would be considered fraud under the new bill?
Well, if you conceal something on your application for a WEDIC grant asks for, you know, have you ever done or how much money have you made, or something like that. If you actually intentionally lie, and again, you have to have intent there behind it, or you conceal that your assets, you know, to gain, you know, something from state government. Again, those would be the two things that the district attorney would look at.
Now, earlier this month, the board itself adopted policies to guard against fraud and saying that they would refer some of these cases to law enforcement. Why don't you think that was enough?
Well, like I said, there's already specific fraud statutes on the books that we have used in other areas of state government. And again, it's hard to sometimes prove intent because they're very generically written. So again, this would be specific to frauding out WEDC, just like in my unemployment, you frauded out two strikes and you were out of the unemployment program. Again, it was very specific to unemployment. So again, giving that tool in the toolbox for folks that fraud and conceal and hide.
We're talking right now with Representative Samantha Kirkman, state representative in the 61st Assembly District in Wisconsin, and we're talking about her new bill to make it a felony to defraud the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. This is being done with Democratic Senator Dave Hansen. And Representative Kirkman, you and Senator Dave Hansen say that this bill's proposed criminal penalties are similar to those that are already in existence for things like defrauding public assistance programs, things like food stamps. How do you see those as being similar?
Well, anytime somebody frauds state government, be it, you know, $100 or be it $1 million, again, that's still a crime against the, you know, the taxpayers of Wisconsin who've paid that money into the state. And so I do believe that there should be deterrence on the books to, you know, prevent people from wanting to do that. You know, anytime I do a fraud bill, again, I've been the co-chair of the audit committee now for 4 years and have done several fraud bills. I wanted to make sure that the bill is written correctly, that it's available. But overall, my hope is that nobody has to use this law. And because, unfortunately, there are bad actors out there in all areas of our state. You know, this is probably going to be used in the future, but I hope it never has to be.
Do you see this being used by officials from WEDIC in conducting due diligence on some of these applications before, say, they get to the point of this?
Well, and I think that's where the policy changes. You know, that came out through the audits that was the past two audits that have been done. You know, I was on the audit committee, not the co-chair at the time, when we did the previous audit of the Department of Commerce. Unfortunately, I had a situation down in Kenosha County where we gave out a sizable grant, a loan, to a company, and that company's never come. We, in turn, had to actually pay that money back to the federal government because then we actually got that, it was a block grant from the federal government. So just in this budget, did we actually have to pay back the federal government on something that never came to fruition? Now, WEDIC and Department of Commerce have definitely changed their business plan, which is, I think, important to give people confidence that when they are giving out, you know, grants and loans to companies who are making investments here in Wisconsin, that we are going to get our return on those dollars. And, you know, Kenosha County, where I represent, has been very successful in the last 3 years. We have 5,500 jobs coming on in Kenosha County. We have several businesses that have moved here, businesses that have expanded in Kenosha County. We have right now a worker shortage in Kenosha County, you know, because we have so many opportunities through Amazon, Kennel, Honda Cylinders, Niagara Bottling. I mean, and the list goes on and on. So it's hard to be a legislator sometime in my area and not talk about all the great things that are happening. That WEDC and our local partners, the county exec, Jim Cruiser, and our Kenosha Area Business Alliance have really, we've worked together as a team to try to make, you know, Wisconsin, you know, stronger.
And this bill is recent, as we said. Do you and Senator Hansen feel that you've got enough bipartisan support to make this through the legislature?
You know, I'm really hopeful. You know, over the last few months, I've been talking about this issue. I didn't have a bill draft. As soon as we got the bill draft, obviously, Senator Hansen and I sat down and worked together. We have several co-sponsors, bipartisan co-sponsors on this bill. So I hopeful that it does make it through the legislature very quickly into the governor's desk for a signature.
Do you have any sense of how WEDIC officials feel about it?
I have reached out to them. They're supportive. I've also reached out to the governor's office. I've tried to work some of those and let people know that this bill was coming. It does make it easier than to say, hey, we're going to do this. I'm really one of those legislators. I had this idea, tried to reach out to the people that, you know, I need their support as well.
Now, Democratic lawmakers earlier this month, they introduced a bill to overhaul the agency, saying that it doesn't work, it's not working. Do you hope that this bill does something to help answer those concerns?
You know, and I have looked at that as well. And Senator Lassa and Representative Barca, and Peter and I represent Kenosha County together. Some of their points are very, very valid. And I think the board now, the WEDC board, has made significant progress into addressing some of those concerns that came up previously. You know, the one thing I do worry about when we do the overhauls, when we even did the overhaul of the Department of Commerce, is that I don't want to hurt our brand. You know, we have so many good things happening right now in the state. I know it's not touching every area, and I'm very fortunate that I represent southeastern Wisconsin. But when southeastern Wisconsin is strong, and Madison is strong, and Milwaukee is strong, the rest of the state is stronger because people in my area then have that extra disposable income. They might come up north and go snowmobiling that extra weekend, or in the summertime take an extra trip up there, which then generates more revenue and income into our state's economy, which is critical.
Representative Kirkman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
That was Representative Samantha Kirkman from Assembly District 61 discussing her new bill to make it a felony to defraud the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which is the state's job creation agency. A favorite tradition at this time of year is to send holiday cards. And like with so many pieces of Americana, the Wisconsin Historical Society has an incredible collection.
Besides offering the chance to see art from different eras, these cards can also provide a glimpse into the social, political, and economic issues of their times. Joining us to talk about what we can learn about American history through Christmas cards is James Slattery. He's a volunteer in the Library Archives Digital Lab at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Season's greetings.
And to you. So how long have people been sending each other Christmas cards?
Well, it would appear that it's about 170 years or so. They commonly attribute the first commercially published Christmas card to Sir Henry Cole, who commissioned it in London in 1843. And that card, I think, kind of set the stage for all the cards that followed. It's a celebratory card. It shows a multi-generational group raising a toast to the season. And there's two other smaller images on the card, and both of them show acts of mercy. So it's a celebration combined with remembering our fellow man and some charitable acts together with that. Now, this card didn't just magically appear. I think it really did reflect some changing times in England and, of course, in the United States as well, although the U.S. was a little later in adopting the Christmas cards. But it's no mistake or accident that in the 1840s was the publication of Christmas Carol and Charles Dickens kind of standardizing a view of a traditional Christmas celebration that may or may not have been uniform across much of the world, but at any rate, it was built upon in this country by Thomas Nast in Harper's Weekly, who kind of literally fleshed out our view of Santa Claus, and then things picked up around 1870 or so in the United States with the introduction of beautiful chromolithographic greeting cards, notably produced by Louis Prang in the Boston area.
So, Jim, do holiday cards reflect the era in which they're created? Are they kind of a window into different social or political or even economic issues that are happening at those times?
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes in a very overt kind of way, in the late Victorian era, children in general were coming to be more valued as members of society and given gifts and that type of thing, and certainly Christmas cards celebrate that as well. And it takes you back to remember that child labor laws weren't passed until well into the 20th century, and yet Christmas cards show pictures of children receiving gifts that we required money to buy, and that wasn't always good supply back in those days, so you really had to have a middle class and a cash economy for a celebration of Christmas as depicted on those Christmas cards. And it was growing through that time, as was literacy. That's another thing that's a requirement for Christmas cards. And as the populace became more educated and economically better situated, then they had the luxury of sending these cards. Things like, you know, world dramatic events such as depressions and wars are also reflected in Christmas cards. I think wars it's more apparent in wartime Christmas cards. They're patriotic. Sometimes they even show warships and planes and that much, and pray for peace and pray for our soldiers overseas are themes on Christmas cards. Things like economic depressions, maybe not so much. I know in the collection online there's just one card that shows a man sitting alone by a campfire outside in kind of a bleak field. You can see a train in the distance and almost hear its whistle. But that's really the exception. Most Christmas cards are upbeat and full of hope and good cheer, and that's as it should be, I think.
Well, one thing that surprised me was that these holiday cards that people send that show their whole family as the picture on the card, I thought those were a recent invention, and it looked like you had some going back to 1960 or so.
Oh, certainly. As a baby boomer myself, I remember those very clearly. And not only there's a great pair of cards in the collection that show a family in 1953 with five boys, and about 10 years later, their Christmas card shows a total of nine boys and a little girl, and they're lined up like stair steps. And that really took me back because I come from an era of larger families and photo postcards, and even other Christmas cards reflected the exuberance and the optimism of that baby boom era. If you look at cards from the 30s, they can be kind of dreary. They're in dark colors, and they're obviously to be sent from adult to adult. But once the war is over and the baby boom is underway, the cards are very lighthearted. You see Disney characters, Santa, Rudolph, Frosty, obviously all on the Christmas cards. And you almost wonder why they didn't run out of exclamation points, because they're just so upbeat in their messages of, you know, Merry Christmas and all of that. So, and as I say, so you have kind of the very obvious photo postcards of these literally growing families alongside these very joyful and exuberant animated, almost animated cards that came along in that period of time.
Well, Jim, sadly, we're out of time. There's a lot to talk about, but thanks for joining us and helping us get in the holiday spirit.
You're very welcome. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. That was Jim Slattery. He's a volunteer in the Library Archives Digital Lab at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he talked with us about how Christmas cards reflect the times in which they were sent. You can find a link on the Central Time Facebook page to the more than 200 holiday cards in the Wisconsin Historical Society's digital archives. A recent report from the Pew Research Center shows that the Americans in the middle income group are no longer the economic majority. The study shows that people on the fringes, both high and low income, now outnumber those middle wage earners, which follows a trend that's been ongoing since the 1970s.
And while more people have been squeezed to the edges, the report shows that high income households are receiving a larger share of total income at the expense of the lower and middle income households.
For more on the current state of middle income earners and the reasons behind this shift in the economy is Michelle Dickerson. She's the Arthur L. Moeller Chair in Bankruptcy Law and Practice at the University of Texas at Austin. Michelle, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back again.
So this Pew study covers a lot of ground in focusing on the shrinking middle-income population. One of the things you noticed most was how polarized household income has gotten. What does that mean exactly?
What it means is when the number of people in America that were economically middle class was 61%, and that was the number in the early 1970s, most of the income that was earned in the country went to the middle class. That's no longer true. And so what we've seen over the last about 45 years is people being squeezed out of the middle class and being pushed to the fringes. So we're now having more and more people in this country who are very poor and very rich, and not as many in the middle.
So another thing that struck you was how well people who are already well off are doing. What does the report tell us about those people on the higher income fringe?
They're doing not only well, but quite well. So when we look at, for example, we'll look at employment, most of the jobs that are being created are no longer sort of high-wage, middle-skilled. A lot of the earnings are going to the very richest of all Americans because the job creation is in the STEM area, science, technology, engineering, and they are being paid exorbitant amounts of money. And not so much for the working middle class or for the people who are being pushed into the low-wage jobs on the other end of the economic spectrum.
I want to make sure we all know what we're referring to or who we're referring to when we talk about middle income earners. And of course, it depends how many people are in a household. But say for a family of three, what is that range for people who are considered middle income earners?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. The middle income, at least in the Pew report, is defined differently from middle class. So middle income earners are roughly 40,000 to 120,000. There are many people who may define themselves as middle class who in fact may not be middle income. So when we see the term middle class used, middle class could include people who own homes mm-hmm. but don't earn a lot mm-hmm. of money. A lot of people self-identify as being in the middle class when, in fact, they may be lower income. So one really great thing about the Pew report is that it focuses almost exclusively on income and not sort of the fuzzy mm-hmm. definition of middle class.
I have to say a range of 40,000 to 120,000 is an awfully big range, and I would think the experience of living as a $40,000 a year income earner versus 120 is really different.
Right, and it varies dramatically by city. You can live in Manhattan. It takes you considerably more to live in Manhattan than it does for you to live in a smaller town in Tennessee, for example. But yeah, 42,000 to 126,000 is how the report defines middle income.
So one of the groups that has felt the squeeze the most is those Americans who do not have a college degree. Why do you think that they've had so much trouble, and why is that challenge being exacerbated now?
Well, absolutely. They have lost the most. Since the beginning of the 1970s, people who don't have a college degree have fallen behind, and they continue to fall behind. I would say there's a couple of reasons why people who have a high school degree can no longer really reach either middle income or what we used to think of as the middle class. As I mentioned earlier, many of the jobs that are being created are high-wage jobs, but they're also high-skill jobs, and they require you to have an advanced degree, a four-year degree. The other thing that's happening is for many employers, they are viewing a college degree as a cutoff. Mm. So it used to be the high school degree was what you needed in order to be qualified to get the higher wage jobs. Now it's a college degree. So rather than receiving, if you get 5,000 applications for 500 jobs and you have to sift through 5,000 applications, what employers increasingly are doing is saying, if you have a college degree, you make the cut. If you don't, even though you may be capable of doing the job, you don't even get an interview. You don't even get considered.
So just to get in the door with the possibility of maybe being considered, you really need that college degree today.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of law firms, they've always employed had a position called the runner, and it's basically the person that takes documents from one building to another. Not as important of a job now that so many things are transmitted electronically, but you still need a runner to deliver things. In many law firms now, the runners have to have a college degree. And there's absolutely no reason other than it's just an easy cutoff. More people are going to college now than they did in the 1970s, so employers can demand a college degree, and you have a healthy group of unemployed workers with college degrees that are happy to take jobs that in the 1970s would have been staffed by someone with a high school degree.
We're talking with Michelle Dickerson. She's the Arthur L. Moeller Chair in Bankruptcy Law and Practice at the University of Texas at Austin. We're discussing a recent report from the Pew Research Center that takes a look at middle-income wage earners in the United States. Now, Michelle, one of the things that stands out in that issue with the college degree and kind of what the cutoff is now for having a chance at being a middle income earner is that the landscape of manufacturing jobs has really changed a lot. How would you characterize that development since, say, the 1970s?
If we think of what America looked like, especially in the Rust Belt, so in, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, you had large plants. Detroit is probably the perfect example. You had large auto manufacturers. And if you looked inside those plants, what you would find are humans. You would find lots of workers who had high wages, and they were the ones on the assembly line. If you look at the auto manufacturers now and you peeked inside the plants, you won't see only humans. You'll also see robots. And so what has happened is technology has advanced to the stage that a lot of things that we used to rely on human beings to do, the task inside of a manufacturing plant, you can now use robots to do. So you need fewer humans to do it, and you don't have to pay them as much.
So, Michelle, one of the groups that is actually doing better is older people, retired people, and they're actually moving up in income and in class instead of moving down. And the number of elderly people in poverty has actually gone down quite a bit. To what do you attribute that?
There are a couple of things. The report focuses on people who are 65 years and older. People who are 65 years and older, for the most part, spent their entire working lives in the old economy. And the old economy was you graduated from high school, maybe you graduated from college, you went to work for a company, you stayed with that company for, if not most of your life, a large part of your working life, and you had this thing called a pension that your employer provided for you. So when they came to the point of retiring at age 65, people that had worked in the old economy for most of their working lives, they had both a guaranteed pension and also Social Security. So they aren't harmed as much. They also, for the most part, bought their homes and had paid off their homes before the housing crash. So it wasn't terribly surprising to me when I saw that people 65 years and older were doing relatively better than other demographic groups, because they came, sort of grew up and worked in America at a time where you could make it on a relatively lower income, and then when you did retire, you had a stable pension.
We're talking to Michelle Dickerson about the shrinking population of middle-income earners in America.
And we want to hear from you. Do you consider yourself middle class? Have you felt squeezed over the last few years, even though you're in that middle-income bracket? And what do you think would reverse the decline of people in that middle tier? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're discussing a recent study that shows middle-income earners in America are now in the minority following a four-decade decline.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you consider yourself middle class, and are you feeling that squeeze that we're talking about, even though you may be in that middle-income bracket? And do you think something could be done to reverse the decline of people in that earning category? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Michelle Dickerson is with us. She's a professor of bankruptcy law and practice at the University of Texas, Austin. I want to go back to something, Michelle. You talked about the fact that there's a difference between the middle class and being a middle income earner, because middle class can also take into account things that are not necessarily money coming into the household, but owning a house or owning a car, other kinds of assets. What kinds of things do Americans associate with being middle class? And do you think there's an expectation if we are middle income earners that we should have what we see as kind of the rights of being middle class?
I think there is. Most people who have sort of worked hard and played by the rules don't understand why they can't have a lifestyle that's middle class. Not an extravagant lifestyle, but just the middle class lifestyle that we've come to associate with, you know, going to college, you know, getting married, having a couple of kids, one or two kids, and working hard. It's becoming increasingly difficult for people to achieve a middle class lifestyle, even though they've worked hard and played by the rules, because the rules have changed on them.
Well, and it seems like one of the things that could both affect people who are middle income earners, who are parents, and then also those young people who are trying to achieve middle class status is the weight of student debt and college loans. That we are now saying, if you need those college degrees to even have a chance at being a middle income earner, a lot of that comes with debt.
Exactly. And you have to go to college. I mean, it pains me to say that, and I've said that in one of the undergraduate classes that I taught, but college really, the college, four-year college degree is becoming a cutoff, whether we like it or not. The debt that's associated with going to college is decimating both the young and the old. So younger people are increasingly returning to their parents' home to live even after they've graduated from college. And that's not the typical cycle, the lifestyle cycle that we expect. We think that the child leaves the home, graduates from high school, leaves the home, goes to college, graduates, and sets up their own household. We're not seeing that because a lot of people who are graduating from college can't afford to both repay their student loan debt and pay rent and live. That's actually one of the reasons that the home ownership rates are still flat since the recession, and one of the reasons that we can't get the housing market to really get back up and moving, because the people that should be buying those starter homes aren't. And then on the parents' end, we are seeing larger numbers of senior citizens having to file for bankruptcy because of the student loan debt that they have because they helped their kids to go to college. So it really is a catch-22. If you don't go to college, it is clear that you're going to struggle financially. But if you do go to college, you're also likely to struggle financially because of the amount of the student loan debt.
Let's go to the phones, and Billy in Augusta is up first. Hi, Billy.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I've been in the construction business my whole life. I'm 64 years old. I thought maybe I'd retire and kind of settle down a little bit. My kids are all moved away, and everything's good. But all the young men, I would say, not women, men, who come to work for us are not cut out for the construction business. They all want to talk on the computer. They all want to do the cell phone thing. They want to do all that stuff. That's not the business. If you want to go into construction, if you want to work hard, there's jobs out there. We're begging for people. Electricians, plumbers, all of them, we're begging for people. So I don't know what a four-year degree is going to get you in mass communication when you have to run pipes for a living.
All right, thanks for that call, Billy. And Michelle, we also had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who wanted to know, what about technical degrees? That caller read that a lot of jobs, that's really what you need instead of a college degree. So where are we at in, say, the skilled trades, and is that a path to middle-income earning?
Yeah, I think both your other caller and also Billy make a great point about the importance of technical degrees. And community colleges have, and I think will continue to do, really great work in that area. I will say that one place where we're not getting as much help anymore are in high schools. So again, if you look at the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, Billy's age puts him in the range where he would have been going to high school at the time, where the high schools actually did a lot of training in terms of technical training. In most high schools in the United States, we no longer have that. And one of the reasons we don't have that is because of the state testing requirements. So technical education that used to be robust in the 1960s, 1970s, and at least early to mid part of the 1980s, they've largely been gutted because we have to add more courses so that the students can pass the state-mandated test at the end of the year. They're absolutely right that better technical training for our young millennials would be great. It would be wonderful if we could have more of the technical training coming from high schools. It also would be wonderful if the for-profit colleges actually provided that type of education instead of charging exorbitant amounts in tuition and then having students to graduate buried in debt but not great, really no trade skills.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much. There's so much in the report that we could have touched on, but you did a good job of helping us kind of sort through those numbers.
Thanks for having me.
That was Michelle Dickerson. She is the Arthur L. Moeller Chair in Bankruptcy Law and Practice at the University of Texas, Austin. She was discussing with us a recent Pew Research Center study that shows that Americans in the middle income earner class are no longer in the majority, and that Pew Research Center poll and study was just released this week.